Hello, and welcome to Silver Threads, a weekly program of information on how you can make your senior year shine. I'm Kathy Van Skoik. The September issue of AARP magazine features two influential senior women in the film industry. In an interview by Kenneth Miller, Jessica Lange, 68, winner of innumerable acting awards, comments on her career, the meaning of home, her humanitarian involvement, happiness, older women in Hollywood, and the joy of family. Award-winning filmmaker Sheila Nevins shares on a defining moment in her life when a stranger disparaged her mother that led her to the deep involvement in producing documentaries she does today. I've researched her work and will report on several of her important contributions, but we'll start with Jessica Lange. Can finally relax after collecting every major acting award? Is it time to kick back? We reveal all through the years in her words. Jessica Lange makes me nervous. Over 40 years of intense Edge of Madness performances, she specialized in playing high-strung characters with dangerous dark sides. At 68, she's still intimidatingly gorgeous, and as she moves across the backyard of a rented Beverly Hills mansion to meet me, I feel my palms dampen. But then she stops short. "Look," she exclaims, "a hammock and a daybed. My favorite things, places to nap." She drops into the hammock, taking a blissful swing as a hummingbird buzzes overhead. It's rare and somewhat reassuring to see Lange in laid-back mode. She is known, after all, for roles such as the self-destructive actress in Frances, 1982, and the hermit heiress in HBO's Grey Gardens, 2009. Lange portrayed another troubled star, Joan Crawford, in this year's FX series, Feud. As an actress, Lange has seldom chosen the easy path or failed to persist. Propelled by a spirit of adventure, she voyaged from small-town Minnesota to the bohemian outposts of Paris and Manhattan, then to her first Hollywood screen test. Panned for her movie debut as the damsel in distress in 1976, King Kong, she kept honing her skills until she was ready for something better. After a slew of acclaimed films, she made her first Broadway foray at 43. When the production got poor reviews, she kept returning to the stage until she earned raves. She took on Shakespeare at 50 and plunged into series television at 62. Along the way, she picked up two Oscars, Best Supporting Actress Tootsie and Best Actress, Blue Sky, 5 Golden Globes, 3 Emmys, and in 2016 for her role in Long Day's Journey Into Night, a Tony for Best Actress. Lange has been just as bold off the screen. She threw herself into long-term liaisons with larger-than-life men, dancer Mikhail Baryshnikov, who gave her a daughter, and playwright-actor Sam Shepard, with whom she had a son and a daughter, before they separated in 2009. Fiercely protective of her family's privacy, she raised her kids in rural hideaways, but has never hesitated to venture forth when the cause is right. Since 2003, she has served as a goodwill ambassador for UNICEF. Lange announced in 2013 that she was thinking of retiring, yet has shown no sign of slowing down. Her staying power isn't just about the boom and meaty roles for older actresses on television. It's the desire to do something brave, she says, to be challenged. And her on the meaning of home, Cloquet, Minnesota. "My father was a traveling salesman and a teacher, and we moved around a lot. I went to 8 different schools. I was always the new girl in town, the outsider looking in. I felt that way my whole life, like I never belonged in one particular place. The imagination was my escape and my entertainment. That's what acting still is for me." Disastrous movie, gritty response. King Kong, 1976. Getting cast as the Fay Wray role was such a fluke. I was just back from Paris and all skin and bones with a white afro, and they took one look at me and said, she's not right. But then they flew me out to MGM to put me on camera. What did they have to lose? And by the time I left, I had the part. I had no idea how big the movie was or that coming out of it, I wouldn't be taken seriously. I went back to taking acting classes for a few years. When you're young, you don't see the connections, how one thing leads to another. The truth about Jack. The postman always rings twice in 1981. Jack Nicholson and the director, Bob Rafelson, were incredibly kind and generous, trusting an unproven actress with a major dramatic role. I learned a lot from being around Jack. He's one of the great film actors of all time. He understood the camera and what to do when. He showed me the power of gesture. Mikhail Baryshnikov, partner from 1976 to 1982. When I first met Misha, there was something so familiar about him, physically, emotionally, everything. A simpler time, first Academy Award, 1983. I knew when I did Francis that it was something extraordinary. I love those kinds of parts, with huge emotional swings. But Tootsie turned out to be the best film I ever made, and to win my first Oscar for it was thrilling. Not terrifying the way it might be today. The awards were more casual then. You did your own hair, you did your own makeup. It wasn't the fashion event of the season. If at first you don't succeed, A Streetcar Named Desire, 1992. I hate not getting performances right. Blanche DuBois was a part I had always been in love with. Ultimately, I wasn't really prepared for it. I didn't understand stage the way I did film. The critical response was negative. It was hard, but I kept trying, and finally, with Long Day's Journey, we had a great production. Digging Deep. Blue Sky, 1994. My connection to the manic depressive character of Carly came organically. You draw on grief, sadness, rage, those things in your own life. What's interesting is to let something emerge that surprises you. Sam Shepard, partner from 1982 to 2009. I wouldn't call Sammy easygoing and funny, but everybody has their dark side, and he always does it with a sense of humor. Helping in Congo, UNICEF Mission, 2003. A civil war was just getting started. I met women who had walked through a jungle for days with terrible injuries carrying their children. I can't go in and help the way Doctors Without Borders does, but at least I can try to raise awareness. Behind the Leads. 50 Photographs by Jessica Lang, 2008. I've been taking photographs for about 20 years now. I love to be the anonymous observer, capturing small dramas that no one else has noticed. Unhappiness. In recent years, I've tried to come to grips with the idea that you can actually choose to be happy. You can choose not to let things affect you negatively. I've always had such a quick temper. I realize now it's such a waste of energy. You can actually choose to let things roll off you. Fear Factor, American Horror Story, 2011 to 15. Horror has never been my favorite genre, but Ryan Murphy, the producer, is a great seducer. I thought, I'll do it for a year. And it turned out to be 4 years of amazing roles. Television has been great. On Older Women in Hollywood. Ageism is pervasive in this industry. It's not a level playing field. You don't often see women in their 60s playing romantic leads, yet you will see men in their 60s playing romantic leads with co-stars who are decades younger. I think about how few wonderful actresses of my generation are still doing viable, important film work. You go to television, you go to the stage, you do whatever you can because you want to keep working. My first children's book. It's about a little bird, 2013. It started as a little story I wrote for my granddaughters. I was very interested in turn-of-the-century photographs and the way they would be hand-tinted. So I collected a lot of photographs I had taken of the kids and started hand-coloring them. Then the story came together after I had a dream, and I put it together as their Christmas present as a book. And then a friend of mine saw it and said, "You should publish this." On the Joy of Family. Having children gives you a perspective you didn't have before. You are no longer the center of the universe. It opened my heart, made me a different person. Every move you make is with someone else in mind. I loved being a mother more than anything else in the world, and being a grandmother is even more fun. There's the chance to do it again. It's in the perfect order of nature. You raise your children, and then the next generation comes along. They are the redemptive force in nature. Plus, it's easier. And she says, now the only thing I care about is it thrilling and am I doing something I haven't done before? But five things you didn't know about Jessica Lange. 1, Dylan Unbound. Lange says she can sing every lyric Dylan ever wrote. He was a transformative artist in my life. 2, if she could change one thing, it would be her absolute willfulness. 3, Tale of Two Tats. Lange got her first tattoo in Paris at age 19, a crescent moon on her hip, the smallest one they offered. She also has a Celtic knot on her wrist. Her older daughter is similarly inked. Casper Friendly. I have seen a presence. Most ghosts are easy and benevolent. And 5, on loneliness. Where I grew up, it seeps into your bones. Seems I've spent my life trying to fill it up. And now we're going on to Defending My Mother, when filmmaker Sheila Nevins first vowed to take a stand. Chock Full of Nuts was an old-time coffee shop with great raisin cream cheese sandwiches and coffee that was always the right kind of hot. Hardly the place for a game changer, and yet it happened to be one for me. My mother was born with an awful disease called Raynaud's phenomenon. Most of the time, Raynaud's simply means you have a lack of circulation in your extremities. Annoying, yes, but nothing to be alarmed about. But my mom had a severe case, the kind where your fingers, toes, and even arms and legs would lose circulation and go from blue to black and then become gangrenous. It's incredibly painful, and if they turn black, they never heal, and then they die, and the only treatment is amputation. I grew up fearful of decay. A black nail meant a finger above the knuckle was in danger and eventually would come off. My mother's disease started ruthlessly with her fingers. First, it was the second fingertip on her left hand, and then, over the years, it progressed. Mount Sinai Hospital in New York was my second home. I knew all the nurses. I knew exactly how much change was needed in every vending machine. I wanted sweet things. Life was sour. Yet no raisinets, no jujubes or almond joy could take away the bitter taste of life's brutal entrance fee. Mom, I would say, why do we live if we have to suffer? And my mom would say, what's the choice? And so it would be that I grew up sad and terrified, thinking every cold was terminal pneumonia, every small paper cut a future amputation. After all, I was my mother's daughter. My mother was hard on me. I never seemed to do anything right. Pain disturbed any pleasure she might have had. In any event, she might need my nursing skills. If I resisted this servitude, I would be blamed. She told me again and again that I was selfish. We didn't have money for help. My mother was angry about living in hell, and I was her closest driver in this river Styx. Sure, I had a sister, but she was 7.5 years younger. So, of course, I was her caretaker. Sheila, do this. Sheila, do that. Sheila, you didn't do this. Sheila, you didn't do that. I loved my mother, but at the same time resented her. While my friends' mothers shopped and worried about the color of their hair as it turned gray and their fire and ice matching lipstick and nail color, I lived in a private war-torn universe. I lived with a noose around my neck, and so I became me. My father was never home. He worked at the post office, booked bets for the mailmen, and spent his nights playing cards in what were known then as goulash joints on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. These were working middle-class clubs where men would play poker for cash and bet on horses and sporting events. They all smoked. My father smoked 3 packs a day. His name was Benny P.O. Hey, Benny, I want to bet on the Knicks game. What are the odds? Who's the favorite? One day, when I was a sophomore living in a Barnard dorm, frequently commuting home at my mother's beck and call, my mom came uptown for lunch. She was driving a newly equipped car with odd handbrakes that could be maneuvered with her elbow. She was proud of its adaptability, and she zoomed citywide thanks to the Rusk Institute, the post office's medical plan, and Volvo mechanics. By the time she had suffered an amputation of her left arm just below her elbow, as ugly as the amputation was, it was a great improvement over the creeping crud of gangrene and the excruciating pain of a dying limb. In 1960, my mom was only in her early 40s. This seemed old to me then. I was born when she was 22. She had come that day for lunch, wanting to go to Chock Full of Nuts to get one of their famous raisin cream cheese sandwiches and the always just right coffee. She seemed happy for once to see me, happy to be mobile and driving by herself, happy to be ambulatory, though amputated. It was a sultry, too warm day in May. My mother's pleated dress had long sleeves, the one on the right arm rolled up, and the one on the left tied in a knot below the stump. There must be a better word for stump, but frankly, why euphemize the ugly? The air conditioning in the restaurant was off. It was tolerable, but Mom was hot with the knotted sleeve. That amputated arm had ghost-like sweat that would often roll down and wet the inside as if the stump were crying and trapped without air. Mom said her arm was stifling. I rolled up her left sleeve, untying the knot. I unbuttoned the second button of her dress and fanned her with my study notepad. "Any better?" I asked. "Not really," she said. Our sandwiches came and the perfect coffee. Hot on a hot day, but perfectly so. Mom rested her stump on the counter. Her shortened arm was heavy to lift and too short to hide below the counter. Suddenly, from the other side of the S-shaped counter, a middle-aged woman with a kinky perm, bob, and harlequin glasses, who was fanning herself with a newspaper, yelled out, "Please, ladies, I'm eating. It is rude to expose that arm. It makes me want to throw up." That's what she said. That's what I remember she said. And every time we'd tell this story to close friends or sympathetic physical therapy folk or just to each other, that's what my mom remembered she'd said too. I apologized to this witch, which was odd for me. I wasn't the apologetic type. I was afraid she would hurt me or make a bigger scene. I rolled down the sleeve and retied the knot. Sorry, I said to her. I was embarrassed. Everything was going too fast. Customers started taking sides. The woman to our left said that the lady who spoke out was crazy. Yet a man on our right said that after all, this is a place to eat, and some things are not meant to be seen while eating. The two squabbled, these strangers. Mom and I hurried, left the restaurant. The sandwiches were never going to be tasty again. The coffee was never going to be right again. All was cold. I cried in the fixed-up car. Mom said the woman was nasty, maybe a little crazy, too. But I cried because I had not yelled back. I should have said, "F you. This is my mom. She has a horrible, horrible disease that you are lucky enough not to have." I was furious that I had apologized. Why had I? Why was I ashamed? Why had I let this woman seize this moment? Why? People talk of moments that make you change, that determine who you are. This moment was mine. I would realize that I understood people and their suffering, and somewhere in defending their difference was a place for me. I had failed once, and I wouldn't fail again. So I would eventually become a documentary filmmaker to champion stories about those who are less fortunate. Mostly, I chose to tell stories of the struggle to triumph in an uncertain and often cruel world. I've always been interested in those who are needing visibility and acceptance, anonymous victims of unfairness, deprivation, and poverty. I guess I was determined to right my ineffectiveness at that lunch counter visit. Documentaries talk back, while I had been unable to. They speak without shyness, no apologizing, blatant truth, ugly at times, yet always true. This essay is excerpted from her new book, You Don't Look Your Age and Other Fairy Tales. And now some of the documentaries she has been involved in and a little bit more about her. Sheila Nevins was born April 6, 1939, and has been president of HBO Documentary Films since 2004. She has produced over 1,000 documentary films for HBO and is one of the most influential people in documentary filming. She has worked on productions that have been recognized with over 65 Primetime Emmy Awards, 46 Peabody Awards, and 26 Academy Awards. Nevins has won 32 individual Primetime Emmy Awards, more than any other person. She was born in Manhattan to Stella, a chemist, and Benjamin, a Russian immigrant, post office worker, and bookmaker. She began her career at the United States Information Agency as an actress in Adventures in English. In 1975, she began working as a writer and producer for the Children's Television Workshop. She also worked at Scribner, making recordings of books for the blind. Nevins was a researcher and then associate producer for The Great American Dream Machine on National Educational Television. She worked under Alvin H. Perlmutter from 1971 to 73 and did Man on the Street interviews. Nevins was a field producer for The Reasoner Report on ABC News in 1973, and she wrote for Time Life Films from 1973 to 75. Working briefly for 2020. Nevins was a producer for the CBS News magazine, Who's Who, and she declined Don Hewitt's invitation to be a producer for 60 Minutes. In 2007, she wrote an introduction for the book, Addiction, Why Can't They Just Stop? And now some of her documentaries. One Survivor Remembers. It's a 1995 documentary short film by Kay Antheles in which Holocaust survivor Gerda Weissman-Klein recounts her six-year ordeal as a victim of Nazi cruelty, including the loss of her parents, brother, friends, home, possessions, and community. Unchained Memories is a 2003 documentary film about the stories of former slaves interviewed during the 1930s as part of the Federal Writers Project and preserved in the WPA Slave Narrative Collection. This HBO film interpretation, directed by Ed Bell and Thomas Lennon, is a compilation of slave narratives narrated by actors emulating the original conversation with the interviewer. The slave narratives may be the most accurate in terms of everyday activities of the enslaved, serving as personal memoirs of more than 2,000 former slaves. The documentary depicts the emotions of the slaves and what they endured. The master had the opportunity to sell, trade, or kill the enslaved for retribution should one slave not obey. Death in Gaza, 2004 documentary film about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, opening with the West Bank but then moving to Gaza and eventually to Rafah, where the film spends most of its time with following children in different aspects of their lives. They are Ahmed 12, Mohammed 12, and Najia 16. She showed them doing such things as running toward, throwing rocks and homemade explosive, or kugwas, at armored vehicles. The film also makes note of the political use of public mourning for conflict enhancement. And martyrdom? For a short while, the film concentrates on martyrdom and the opinions of the people there about dying for Palestine and Islam. The film follows the boy from being brought into medical center and the initial treatment to his death and public reaction to the parade and his burial and celebration at his success in becoming a martyr. Sheila was the executive producer for I Have Tourette's, But Tourette's Doesn't Have Me, a 2005 documentary featuring children between the ages of 6 and 13 with Tourette's syndrome. The film examines the lives of more than a dozen children who have Tourette's and explores the challenges that they face. Ethel. Ethel is a 2012 documentary that premiered at the Sundance Film Festival. The subject of the documentary is Ethel Kennedy, the widow of Robert F. Kennedy. The Kennedy family is documented in home videos and pictures. Rory Kennedy, one of their 11 children, called her mother's life one of the great untold stories. The film shows the story of a normal family guided by parents who are aware of the need to improve the world around them and encourage their children to acknowledge those needs and do something about it. Scenes include the early years of the family when they lived in the country. Life According to Sam. Life According to Sam is a 2013 documentary film based on the life of Sam Burns, who suffered from progeria. Burns died on the 10th of January, 2014, but in 2013 it won a Peabody Award and an Emmy Award for exceptional merit in documentary filmmaking. And finally, in 2014, she co-produced with Maria Shriver, Paycheck to Paycheck, The Life and Times of Katrina Gilbert. It tells the moving story of a year in the life of one mother whose daily struggles illuminate the challenges faced by more than 42 million American women and 28 million children who depend on them. The film is the unvarnished account of a single mom struggling to get ahead, but constantly getting knocked back by a system that almost seems designed to see her fail. As you can see, she represents what she wanted to represent in her documentaries. I found both women inspiring. Jessica, propelled by a spirit of adventure, who has seldom chosen the easy path or failed to persist, and Sheila, champion of the struggle to triumph in an uncertain and often cruel world. Well, I hope you have found these articles inspiring as well. Thanks for listening today, and until next week, I'm Kathy Van Skoik. You've been listening to Silver Threads, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. The audio producer for the show is Maureen Rich, and I'm Kathy Van Skoik. I hope you will join me again next week for more information and updates for making the best of your silver years. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, wxxi.org.